Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Ananya Malabutla. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at @beyond_headlines. That's @beyond_headlines. In a day and age where technological innovation and information processing systems are driving economic development in society, there exists a frontier that promises to redefine the very fabric of computation. Welcome to quantum computing. In today's Beyond the Headlines podcast, join us as we unravel and explore the future of how the principles of quantum computing can revolutionize the way we process information. From groundbreaking research to real-world applications, we'll navigate through the complexities of quantum mechanics and discuss the incredible potential as well as challenges of this cutting-edge technology. As policymakers grapple with the implications of quantum computing for global security and for the global economy, this BTH podcast seeks to ask the crucial queries about how this transformative technology may shape future policies and regulations. Our first guest for this episode is Professor Darius Ornston. Professor Darius Ornston is an associate professor at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto, where he specializes in innovation policy, specifically the relationship between cooperation and economic change. Today, he joins us to discuss the policy implications and the future of quantum computing as it contributes to the growth of different economies. Thank you so much, Professor Ornston, for joining us today. I'll start off with a couple of questions to mainly engage our audience who might not be so familiar with the idea of quantum computing, but can you please describe what quantum computing is in lay terms for our audience and how it differs from classical computing? And essentially, what are the benefits of quantum computing and why we should invest in it going forward?
Yeah, so at a really basic level, a quantum computer is just a faster, better, conventional computer. It's obviously a little bit more complicated than that. You don't need to understand all the physics behind it in much the same way that you don't need to understand how an airplane works to take advantage of air travel. I don't fully understand it myself, but basically quantum computing takes advantage of the properties that particles exhibit at very, very small scales, which is to say that they can exist in several different states simultaneously. So unlike conventional computing, which uses bits, which are like 0, 1, on, off, up, down, a quantum bit, right, one of these very small like subatomic particles, can be both a 0 and a 1 at the same time, which means instead of two possible values, you have, let's say, 3, right? And if you want a sheet of paper, multiply 2 by 2 by 2 by 2, and you compare it to 3 by 3 by 3 by 3, you'll see that 3 by 3 by 3 by 3 becomes exponentially larger over time as you add more and more qubits or quantum bits to the chain. So this means that quantum computing can be exponentially more powerful than classical computing, right? That obviously comes with tremendous benefits. It's great to have vastly more powerful computers. The two caveats would be, one, it's really difficult to organize particles like this at, you know, micro subatomic scales. So the quantum computing is just not there yet at the point where these are like practical or commercially useful applications. And second, and I can't totally explain why, but the logic of quantum computing is different from classical computing. So technically speaking, it's not just a faster and more powerful computer when quantum computing goes online and becomes popularized. You know, it solves problems in a different way. So it's better for some problems, but there is no advantage for other problems. It really depends on the type of problems you ask the computer.
So I understand that quantum computing has substantial differences from classical computing, and it's highly context dependent on, you know, how it can be utilized. So going forward, I had another question for you. So who would be the basic stakeholders for quantum computing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all stakeholders when it comes to quantum computing, because even if the applications are limited to those problems that fit the logic of quantum computing, the social and economic consequences of that are going to be really vast, right? So we're all going to be impacted by quantum computing when it goes online. However, this is by and large a game that is going to be played by two different actors. It's going to be played by large firms because these machines are extremely expensive and difficult to construct. At the moment, there are a lot of small players and startups in the quantum space. As this technology moves closer and closer to commercialization, I think it's going to attract the interest of larger companies, and they're going to get more involved and start spending more money than they did before. So I don't think this is a revolution that's going to be dominated by 1,000 small enterprises. We're talking about a handful of large companies. And then, of course, in addition to large companies, the other key stakeholders would be states, would be governments, right? Which the superpowers, certainly think US and China, should be working on their own quantum computers. They'd be kind of crazy not to, given the advantages that it can confer.
Absolutely. I was also wondering, can you please tell us a little more about how quantum computing can be used in the field of innovation to enhance economic productivity?
We don't totally know because quantum computing operates on a different logic from classical computing. So we can say that it's really good for running like simulations and physical simulations. So I think it's really good at protein folding. So we can be pretty confident that it'll be relevant and very helpful for the pharmaceutical industry, for developing new drugs, for example. I've heard physicists argue that quantum computing would be very relevant in financial markets for financial trading. I haven't heard that from anyone in the financial services industry, but that certainly seems plausible to me, that you could, you know, identify and profit from anomalies in the market. But then there are all sorts of other potential use cases in terms of logistics, shipping, managing your supply chain, so on and so forth. The real challenge is figuring out how to leverage the power of these quantum computers as they come online by asking them the right kinds of questions, where you can take advantage of quantum advantage versus classical computing. And that's a whole separate issue from the fact that the quantum computing platform providers are going to be large firms. Outside of that, in terms of the use or diffusion of quantum technology, I think it's going to be quite uneven among, you know, larger firms with more talent and human capital and smaller firms who have no idea how to take advantage of this technology.
Absolutely. And I know that you mentioned that quantum computing can be beneficial for maybe biopharmaceutical applications. Have we seen that COVID-19 has maybe caused an increase in R&D investments towards quantum computing? I know we're not there yet, but have we seen maybe an increase in interest towards it post the pandemic?
I think interest is increasing. I think it's increasing mainly by the producers of quantum technology, and then I think there's a growing concern around encryption, that companies are increasingly aware of risks there, which is a separate issue. I don't know that like the pharmaceutical industry is investing in this, certainly not at a large enough scale to really be driving development. This is still very much a technology that is driven, you know, on the supply side by the people producing the technology without a concrete sense of how exactly it's going to be used. And this is part of the challenge for policymakers. I participated in this expert panel and the conference, Council of Canadian Academies, CCA panel report, Quantum Potential, talked about this sort of challenge for policymakers in the sense of how do you promote technology adoption and technology use when not only are the uses unclear, but it's not entirely certain yet who's going to benefit from the technology. There are no users or adopters that you can talk to because we're so far from commercialization, right? And I'll just underscore that. Like, there are, I mean, I know D-Wave has a quantum computer that is used to like rationalize port operations in LA or something like that. But the capabilities are somewhat limited at this stage, and the applications are quite niche. We're a very long way from figuring out, how it's going to be commercialized.
For sure. So I do understand that there's a lot more research that will be required before quantum computing actually comes into play in our daily lives. However, I was also wondering, are you able to speak to how quantum computing can be utilized in the international affairs context? And potentially, what are some risks that it entails if it's used in the context of international diplomacy, security, or global cooperation? Essentially, what are like some of the pitfalls of quantum computing, and are we there to know them yet?
Yeah, I mean, the most famous use of quantum computing is also the biggest pitfall. So if we're talking about an IR context or diplomacy, one of the sets of problems that quantum computers are really, really good at solving are the problems or puzzles that underpin encryption, that keeps all of our electronic communication secure. This will be broken almost certainly by quantum computers at some point in the future when the technology gets to that stage, right? It's worse than that, though, for two reasons. One, it's entirely possible that governments could figure out how to do this first. And if a government figures out how to break encryption, it is not going to advertise this to the world. We're not going to get headlines the way we do about like quantum advantage achieved, so-and-so builds new supercomputer. You know, China is not going to say that. The US is not going to announce this to the world. Right? So we don't know when that day is actually going to happen. It's unlikely but possible that it's happened already. The second problem, of course, is that governments could, and large governments almost certainly are, hoovering up all of our data and storing it, knowing that they'll be able to break the encryption in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, which means that everything that we're communicating now could be read in 10 years, which is a huge security risk, right? So when we talk about perils, number one, far and away, is breaking encryption. And generally speaking, with quantum computing, there's sort of two sets of risks. One risk is just the acceleration of risks that we already have. The idea that quantum computing is turbocharging artificial intelligence. Well, we already know about artificial intelligence. We have a sense of the trade-offs. This just makes it faster, right? Develop faster. There's nothing really new here. The breaking encryption thing is new. That's new and different and far and away the greatest risk. Oh, but also, right, like, the same simulation, like protein folding exercises that you could use to develop drugs, you could also use to make biological weapons. And it's like really useful if you like to produce, I don't know, nuclear weapons, right? So one could imagine how this would be useful, not just for superpowers, but also rogue agents. Think like, you know, if North Korea were to get its hands on a quantum computer, there's a sort of no shortage of chaos that it could cause in weapons development, in breaking encryption, and then also the point that I made about financial markets, right, and like taking advantage of arbitrage opportunities and so on.
One of the questions I had was, do we see a race of some sorts among superpowers to become experts in the field of quantum computing? And what could this mean for Canada as a nation?
I think we certainly see a race. Governments, large countries, the US, China, and the EU have been spending significantly more money in this space than they were 5 years ago. So given the huge, not just economic, but also security advantages that come from a quantum computer, and I think that's that's probably one of the principal motivations for governments, especially the U.S., China, and so on. They absolutely would love to be, you know, the first to develop this technology, and also to restrict its development in other countries, right? I've spoken about export bans and whatnot, but that's likely coming. I don't think that Canada can realistically expect to play in this space, except maybe as a niche competitor in the field of quantum computing. Certainly on the application side, like figuring out how to use quantum computing technology, I'm sure Canada could do fine. But I think it's very hard to keep pace with the vast sums of money, 10 times larger or even more than 10 times larger, that are being spent now in the US and China. So Canada had an advantage in this space. We had, you know, more quantum technology startups than any other country in the world or something like that, much like our advantage in artificial intelligence. But as we start to approach the point where the use cases are clear, where this technology seems like it might start to become more commercializable, it is attracting the interest of those stakeholders we spoke about before, large companies and large states, in a way that I just don't think it's realistic for Canada to compete with. So Canada, for better or worse, mostly for worse, is going to be, you know, navigating a space where the quantum computers themselves, which are very expensive, capital intensive, hard to build and maintain, are going to be owned by large companies in large countries.
Thank you, Professor. How can governments balance regulatory frameworks to govern quantum computing while fostering innovation and research in the field without stifling the creativity?
Yeah. So I think there are a few dimensions to that. In some ways, to the extent that quantum technology accelerates the development, deployment of artificial intelligence, it intensifies really difficult trade-offs in AI that I have no idea how to resolve. And I'm not convinced that they're resolvable. I think there's some fundamental trade-offs between regulation to enhance privacy and enhance security on the one hand, and the freedom to experiment and innovate on the other. There are trade-offs between the regulatory burden that you impose on companies with, say, like content moderation or addressing issues of algorithmic bias, that costs money, versus, on the other hand, your competition policy, because it's going to require resources to comply with whatever rules you put in place regarding algorithmic bias, how you treat data, all of this stuff. And it's easier for large companies with, you know, more lawyers, more human capital, more resources to comply with that. So you're favoring large firms at the expense of small firms as you try to, right? Artificial intelligence is kind of riddled with these types of regulatory trade-offs that I don't have any like great solutions for. I think there's a role for preserving policy and regulatory discretion. Try not to lock yourself in to like a particular standard or regulatory approach, especially at the international level and global treaties, given the large degree of uncertainty about this. I think data gathering and keeping an eye on what different jurisdictions are doing and how it impacts both, you know, safety and equity on the one hand, but then also flexibility and innovation on the other, is important. And then think about using multiple policies at the same time, right? Combining different policies. So I think the EU is learning this, that as the EU is trying to promote privacy with respect to the use of data, and this is 100% relevant to quantum computing, because quantum computing could make it easier to de-anonymize data. As the EU is trying to enhance like privacy protection, it's realizing that it is unwittingly strengthening companies like Facebook, the larger companies that have an easier time dealing with this regulatory burden and basically penalizing smaller companies. And so it's complementing this with what we might call antitrust or competition policy style measures that sort of weaken, you know, that are targeted at the tech giants, right? That weaken Facebook and Apple to compensate for the fact that it may be strengthening them on the privacy regulation side. So that's a long-winded way of saying that quantum computing basically accelerates trade-offs or dilemmas in areas like artificial intelligence that I suspect are very hard to solve. At the same time, because quantum computing is a hardware, and it's an expensive one at that, there is a sense in which quantum computing is probably easier to regulate in ways that are less harmful to experimentation and innovation. And quantum computing, I mean like, yeah, the hardware. So there's the physical hardware, right? Export bans, right? I think probably one of the best analogs to quantum computing is probably nuclear weapons and nuclear material. But it's going to become that type of regulated technology where you need to fill out a lot of paperwork. And the US and Canada go to great lengths to make sure that you are not exporting certain materials to North Korea or China or Russia or wherever. So that's easier. And then the fact that the quantum computing platforms themselves in the short to medium term are probably going to be operated by large companies also makes it a little bit easier to regulate, because this is not going to be 10,000 mom and pop shops where you don't even know where they are. There's sort of a quantum computing pop-up. You know, my guess is that the computers that can really help you break encryption and stuff like that, you know, for the first 10 years or so, are going to be in a handful of companies where governments know who they are, where they are, and can negotiate with them relatively easily.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Professor Ornstein. And on the same topic, how can industry stakeholders, for example, collaborate with policymakers to establish governance principles to encourage innovation while, again, addressing the ethical or security concerns? So what can industry stakeholders do on their part?
Yeah. In terms of engagement, well, I think, I mean, for one thing, the quantum computers themselves, and this is probably, I mean, we're probably, in much the same way that quantum computing could kind of turbocharge artificial intelligence or accelerate certain aspects of artificial intelligence, it's probably going to accelerate or reinforce certain aspects of what we might call the platform economy, which is to say, you know, a handful of technology providers that basically license out the computer in a kind of like software as a service type of model where you access, no one builds their own quantum computer. There are a handful of quantum computers in like, you know, Seattle, Washington that you access via the cloud, right? So in that sense, industry is going to be an important partner to government in terms of regulating the diffusion of quantum hardware, but also the use, right, the possible uses, right, making sure that this isn't being used by rogue actors to facilitate drug development or something like that. Other ways in which industry should be involved, I mean, I think industry could be useful partners in the search for quantum resistant encryption. And there, maybe the most useful partners are not necessarily industry partners in developing quantum-resistant encryption, which is, it's not the hardest problem in the world. I mean, I certainly don't know how to, you know, develop quantum-resistant encryption, but it can be done. I think the biggest challenge there is rolling out quantum-resistant encryption. And so there's a role for government to partner with industry and say, hey, you really need to up your security. And that's a particular challenge for Canada, which lags on technology adoption and diffusion more generally. And to the extent that you have cozy, you know, telecom or financial services oligopolies, just like don't seem to be competing at all. You know, what's the incentive for them to adopt the latest technology to reassure consumers that their data is safe and secure? You know, I'm not convinced that they're in any rush to adopt this at all. I think the U.S. and the U.S. private sector is already ahead of Canada in that respect. So industry needs to adopt these kind of standards. There's a role for government, especially in a Canadian context, in making and raising awareness and making it easier. And then possibly in the case of these oligopolies, applying pressure in the form of tougher regulatory standards about safeguarding data, right? Safeguarding data in a post-quantum world that we know is coming.
Exactly, Professor. So I think we both can acknowledge that there is currently a lot of uncertainty around the research and around the field of quantum computing. However, asking all these questions can guide our society towards the right direction in being able to answer some of these important questions. So thank you so much for taking a stab at some of these questions. The final question I have is, what are some ways in which public awareness and education initiatives can be leveraged to promote innovation in quantum computing?
Yeah, so there are a few dimensions to that. You know, one is, I think the fact that we're so far from the technological frontier with quantum computing makes things tricky for governments, for policymakers, and also for individuals. And it's difficult for me to articulate this in a concise way, but sort of on the other hand type of situation. On the one hand, I'm deeply worried about the ability of quantum computers to break encryption. And I'm worried because the costs of this problem are not going to materialize for a while. We're not going to realize just how bad it is until there's a quantum computer that can do this. And because those costs are pretty far in the future, this is not the type of problem that policymakers are good at solving. Politicians especially, who are just concerned about winning the next election, are not thinking about how bad this could be in 10 or 15 years, right? And companies, particularly publicly traded ones that are thinking about the next quarterly earnings report, are not necessarily particularly well positioned to deal with something that's not going to be a problem for 10 or 15 years. So part of me worries that we're not taking this seriously enough. At the same time, we want to avoid the kind of breathless, hyperbolic coverage of quantum computing, like this technology is going to revolutionize everything tomorrow. It's not, because we're a ways away from having a useful all-purpose quantum computer. And two, it's not going to be an all-purpose quantum computer, because quantum computing is only advantageous for some applications and not for others. Okay, and so the expert report Quantum Potential talks about the dangers of hyping up the technology too much. And that can be counterproductive for a couple of different reasons. Okay, so one is it can fuel misinformation and just all sorts of crazy mistruths, which lead to, like, you know, bad policy outcomes. It can also lead to complacency when these hyped up claims are disproven, right? So there's a, you know, report tomorrow about how quantum advantage has been achieved, and then it turns out, oh no, actually it was only in this like super contrived scenario. It has no meaningful real world use or application whatsoever. It's very easy to say, oh my God, this quantum computing stuff is just total BS. We don't need to worry about it. But we do need to worry about the encryption thing, because we can be quite confident that that is going to be an issue at some point in the future, right? And so it's a very difficult balancing act between making sure that we stay focused on real risks without getting distracted by, you know, non-existent ones, right?
Excellent. Thank you so much, Professor Ornstein, for joining us today on the BTH episode to discuss about quantum computing. I really hope that our audience was not only able to learn about the fundamentals of quantum computing, but some of the risks that it entails, some of the uncertainty around the field itself, and just some of the actions and questions we should be taking or asking going forward in the future.
So, yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here. If anyone is interested in learning more about the regulation of quantum technology in particular, I recommend that they check out the work of Moritz Kopp, Moritz with a Z, Kopp, K-O-P. He is an incredibly prolific scholar on quantum technology, focusing more on the political and governance side of the technology rather than like the physics and stuff like that. His work is amazing, and I strongly encourage people to check it out.
For those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to Beyond the Headlines. We are a weekly public affairs talk show that airs every Monday at 11 a.m. on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, online and through our website, as well as Twitter and Instagram. You can catch up on our past posts as well as new ones. On today's episode, we're discussing the future of quantum computing. And now, for the second half of the segment, my co-host, Sarah Fian, will be interviewing our next special guest.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Bonneval. And to those who are listening with us today, Joseph T. Bonneval is a PhD and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council for the Geotech Center. He's a subject matter expert for the Department of Defense, where he leads technology incubation and maturation for the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering's Journal of DoD Research and Engineering. So today we're just going to be discussing quantum computing, and specifically with regards to international trade and potential security implications of the growing use of these technologies, if you will. So shall we get started?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And as I always say, for everything I ever do when I do talks, the views and standpoints that I will say represent my viewpoints and not those of the U.S. government or any of my clients. So I always like to get that out the way so that nobody worries about, you know, Joe said the government was going to do this. No, I didn't say that at all.
Wonderful. Okay, so we're going to start with trade and then maybe work our way down to security. I think that's a great structure for this. My first question for you is, how do you see quantum computing impacting international trade and for say the next decade or so, considering they're growing in terms of development?
Absolutely. So I think whenever I think about quantum computing, I think about it in kind of a threefold way. I think Rand recently, or maybe in 2022, they broke it down really nicely, where they said there's essentially three things. There's quantum computing, there's quantum sensing and quantum sensors, and then the last one is quantum communication. All of these things kind of still fall under quantum computing, but when you break them down, there's different trade associations for those things. I think particularly focused on the question here with quantum computing, the trade is going to be, it's going to be interesting how we break it out. So right now, no doomsday scenario for anybody. We're very nascent in our stages of understanding what we can do with quantum computing. So we don't actually know all of the applications. As we begin to know these applications, as we begin to determine which applications could be A for national security, e.g. cyber and anything like that, we'll talk about a little bit later. But as we begin to break down those buckets of how quantum computing will be used, I think that's going to be what is important on the trade applications, because some things will have export controls, and they'll be inherently national security issues. And then some things we want to have open trade for. So, you know, the Human Genome Project, for instance, can use quantum computing to help predict diseases in folks. And so being able to do these things at a much faster scale and at a global scale will allow people from all over the world to be able to use this technology for good. And so I think it really is going to focus on what bucket they fall in, right? So if you want to give my opinion on the buckets, I think you've got the national security bucket, you've got, you know, materials and technology for good bucket, and then you've got everything for the medical side and the sciences side, which is going to be everything from pharmaceuticals all the way down to mapping out the human brain and things of that nature. So I think depending on which bucket you fall in will determine kind of what your trade secrets. And I think, you know, the most restrictive of that will be obviously the national security side. And I think the most open of that will be the pharmaceutical side.
So sort of that juxtaposition between sort of protectionism, potential protectionism, and even international cooperation, just depending on, I guess, what sector of those quantum computing uses will be. That'll be an interesting thing to see in the future.
No, absolutely.
Given like COVID.
Yeah, given COVID, given all the things that we think, you know, this technology can be used for good. Everywhere you go, you're going to have bad actors. But in the ability for us to use it for good, and we'll probably talk about it a little bit later, is the supply chain for actually building these qubits and building actually what you're going to use for quantum computing is where I think the trade is going to be interesting, to say the least, because you've got our near peer threats that are wanting to be quantum leaders. And then you've got the allies for the United States and other countries that are trying to make sure we position ourselves that we have a direct supply chain to these type of technologies easily. And so you've got your Japans and your Finlands and your South Koreas that are really working really well for us to be able to build these things. But we all have to kind of play together in the same pulpit because no country single, you know, there's no country that can do all of the things quantum by themselves. We just don't have the resources and or the money. So I think you'll end up seeing something kind of like what we've done with the International Space Station or the hydron particle accelerator, where everybody came together, threw a little money here, threw a little, you know, 50 million here, 50 billion there. Everybody came together to build something because nobody can do it by themselves. I'll stop there.
No, that was so interesting. I just think it's going to be interesting to see how it like kind of just folds, like fold out in the future and just kind of how it happens and transpires. My second question for you is sort of how might quantum computing and the development of these computers influence trade negotiations and policy making at the international level, but especially for countries that I guess are at like the forefront of developing the necessary pieces for these techs. So like the microchips that are involved and those necessary pieces. And I'm curious to see, I guess, if there is any difference in how they might engage with the global trading, like market and trading system altogether with regards to whether they want to keep those pieces for themselves or how might that play out?
No, I think that's a great question. I think it's an interesting question, but it comes down to kind of what we were saying before, where no one country can afford to just really build this out and have the whole ecosystem for themselves. And so what you'll see, I think, is kind of what you see in the Four Chip Initiative, which just was signed by Biden a few months ago now, where it's South Korea, Japan, United States. I can't remember the fourth country. Maybe it's Australia. I can't remember the fourth country. But essentially what they signed an agreement to say, oh, Taiwan. Taiwan is the fourth country. They wanted to get together to say, we don't ever want to see the same chip supply chain problems that we saw during COVID. So how do we all work together in order to make sure that we don't have these manufacturing problems? Now, obviously, the United States is not going to work with anybody that they consider a near peer threat. But, you know, getting together with these other countries and saying, OK, we want to make sure that we don't have any type of slowdown in anything that we're building or anything that's if there's anything that's going on with manufacturing from that side. Is going to be what drives the international trade agreement, right? So I think the trade policies are going to be really focused on how do we ensure that we get what we need when we need it while giving our allies what they need when they need it. And so one way of making these qubits are these lasers. Qubits, if you're not into quantum computing, are the same thing that you have bytes and bits in your standard computer, but these are on a quantum level. In order to make these, you can either heat them up using very, very sophisticated lasers that come out of Japan, or you can cool them down using the dilation refrigeration, which right now Finland has the market on that, right? So you have two different actors that are in two different areas that we don't, you know, we're not doing that here in the United States. We're more on the R&D side, but actually manufacturing these things, I think, is going to require international trade agreements. And if you're familiar with anything within the DoD and export kind of control things, you start to worry about ITAR regulations and ensuring that your trade secrets aren't sent off and your IP isn't sent off. that is where I think the lawyers are going to be licking their chops when this starts to come out, because they're going to make a lot of money on trying to understand who has the IP, how does that IP move forward, who's getting credit for these things. But all in all, I think, you know, we're from a bottom-down approach right now. So a lot of the academics and the folks in the industry are working across the world together to kind of bring this together. Eventually, when folks begin to understand what buckets this technology and applications are going to come out of, I think that's when you'll get to the good meat and potatoes, if you will. Application of a reality, excuse me.
You kind of cut off a little bit. I'm sorry. Do you mind kind of carrying from meat and potatoes?
Sure. So essentially what'll happen is once we really understand what applications are being developed for what technologies, the meat and potatoes, as I said before, you'll be able to see the buckets and how the trade, international trade policy will change for each thing. So for our allies and our friends and those that work well with us, the national security portion of those and the national security applications won't be so much of a challenge. But for those folks that we may not play in the playpen very well with, that'll be more of a challenge from there. And what you'll end up seeing is either they'll develop it in-house or they'll have to reach out to other partners that are not necessarily allied with the United States and other countries to be able to build that technology. And so then you've got the haves and the have-nots, really. And now you're starting to see what I call a digital divide that's going to continue to grow, because you have a bunch of countries that are very high and technically advanced, and then those trying to catch up, and everybody else is trying to catch up, which brings a whole nother issue together, but I'll stop there.
No, I love that kind of topic, just because it is not only pertinent now, but it's only going to grow in terms of that gap that we're seeing. And I think with the notion of that quantum computing element sort of coming more and more into fruition, we can only expect that to grow unless there's something that sort of changed in the international order. So I love that you brought that comment up. Sort of going back to what you had said about, so speaking from like the bottom up approach, excuse me, of quantum computing development, from that perspective, how are we seeing countries beginning to position themselves in terms of quantum computing research and development to sort of gain that competitive advantage within the global trading system and trading scheme, if you will?
I wish I could say that people are doing more than they are actually doing. You know, there's 173 countries on the, I just looked up the numbers earlier today, 173 or so countries that are doing it. Basically, only about 24 countries have a quantum computing plan, right? So a real plan that is, guys can look it up, anybody that's listening. The Quantum Economy Blueprint Guidance gives you guidance on how to build a quantum plan for your country. And there are countries that have, you know, fully invested into it. There's been different numbers. I've seen 17 countries that are really doing it. I've seen 23, 24. Let's just say that the number's under 30, just to make it a nice, easy number. And out of that, you know, under 30, you know, they're all very highly developed countries, you know. So we're talking, again, most of the European countries. We're talking your Southeast Asian countries, as well as our near peer threats, United States, and I'd say a handful of countries that have the advanced materials that we need. And so I wouldn't say they necessarily have a quantum economy, but they have the necessary tools to build what we need. And outside of that, everybody's kind of just laying low and just kind of seeing how it develops. And to your point earlier, that leaves a lot of people without the necessarily capabilities to really build these things. And so I'm really concerned about how that's going to look. The other half of that, I think, is, you know, one half of that is, do you have some type of plan in place? And I think that's what we just addressed. But the other half of that is talent, right? So the talent pool is probably even more important than anything else. I think all countries are just really vying for this talent. I was reading a study earlier or last week or so that says 50% of postgraduates, 50% of grad students that are studying Quest, which is Quantum Information Sciences Technologies, are foreign nationals. And then on top of that, if you've gotten a PhD, two-thirds of those, so 66-70% or so, are still foreign nationals. And so access to that talent isn't home-based, at least for us here in the United States. And those, we need to find a way to retain that talent here in our states, but also allow that talent to spread back to their home countries and to, you know, back to their home country so that you're building collaboration network. And so I think a lot of, since the U.S. is really leading R&D on this, a lot of countries are sending their talent here and allowing their talent to grow in our universities and our infrastructure, and then bringing them back home so that they can bring that knowledge back home, which is perfect, which I applaud. I don't think anything is wrong with that. We just happen to know that here in the States, all of U.S. born citizens, we're going to need to get into to study in quantum a little bit more because we just aren't studying it enough. And I'll stop there.
Yeah. I think sort of that outreach of, I guess, talent going back home, as you said, it does in one way really help that international potential for international cooperation in that regard. But it also, I do see the limitations, if you will, with that domestic context of, well, how do we make sure that we keep those IPs strong and that we develop everything regarding quantum computing in a way that is domestic and remains domestic for the long haul? I guess this kind of hints back at my first question, but in a very different way. Are there any specific sort of trade sectors or industries that you believe will benefit the most from the advancement in quantum computing technology, or any that will, you know, maybe get hindered by it?
Yeah, so I think this is a great question. I think the world is our oyster. Oh, geez.
I'm so sorry you cut again. Can we? I did not get a single answer. I'm so sorry. I think it's my connection. So just right back from the question, like just your answer.
Okay, sure. No, so this is a great question. I think this is a pertinent question. The world is this oyster when it comes to quantum computing and things it can do. So I'll just give you a few examples of things that I think are going to be cutting. We'll talk about security, I think, a little bit later, but cybersecurity, offensive and defensive. So trusted chain, you know, trusted block ledgers, as well as decryption technologies. From the financial sector, doing risk management, trading at light speed, essentially trying to understand where the market is going. We talked about from the pharmacy standpoint, really being able to discover new drugs and then actually do true physical simulations that we can't do today to really predict the outcome of things. You know, I would include, what else can I include on that kind of in a trade standpoint? Development, human genome project, development of new DNA, not new DNA, but rather sequences to understand and predict cancer and predict things that could work for that. Simulating any type of quantum system is going to be just, it is, I think it's really going to change the world. Now, I think what I mean by that is I think we're very far from that, to be very clear. We're talking about our current systems run about 100 qubits. To really do what we really wanted to do, you'd need about 100 million qubits. But we're getting there, slowly but surely. I think we're scaling up. But I mean, it literally, I'm just taking a look at some of my notes that I had typed up earlier here. Complex financial simulations, risk analysis, supply chain logistics, really understanding transportation routes and supply chains is going to be huge. What else did I put here? Enabling levels of healthcare and efficiency and accuracy and for doctors, really being able to pinpoint your problem for your particular ethnic group to make sure that you can have better healthcare. So like though these impacts on these economies is going to be absolutely crazy in my opinion. So I'm excited clearly, but you know, all of these things, when we talk about the excitement of any new technology, we always have to understand the pitfalls of that technology as well.
1000%. But it is interesting to see maybe the developments in like the healthcare system, or I don't even know what else, I guess engineering that could be taking place with the proliferation of these technologies. Forgive the noise. And what brings me to another question of what are the ethical and regulatory considerations surrounding the use of quantum computing in trade, particularly regarding data privacy and security? Since we brought up that point prior of with any technology, there are its risks. Sort of touching on that, if you will.
No, absolutely. A perfect segue. So I think what we would be concerned about, particularly from an ethical standpoint, is, you know, justice problems. We can talk about fairness and equity and inclusion, right? So we just talked about the fact that 24 countries have a standard of what they're going to do. And so that means they're going to to be developing these technologies at lightning speed, whereas every other country, in my opinion, may be left behind. And what does that mean for somebody that is, you know, from a country that is not developing a quantum framework for the data that they may be supplying that they don't know that they're supplying, right? So you are at a stoplight in a random country with a random car, and you don't know that your data is being collected to be used for supply chain logistics and management. Like, I mean, at this point, you know, people always think about Big Brother and kind of the government gathering this data and not, you're not knowing how it's being used. And I think that's something that you really need to ensure that we have a policy risk management system for it. Again, everything from ethical concerns, human rights concerns. When you gather something that is able to identify and decrypt, decrypt you very easily, you open the floodgates for folks that are non-good actors, bad actors in this society. So we want to make sure we really attack that. The other thing, just kind of continuing on in that thought, we have to be very conscious of what can be happening for things like voting elections and the governance that we've got going on. So risk management, public policy resource, and crisis management. So all of these things, you'll be able to do modeling and simulations at lightning speed, but you've got to be very careful that you are allowing everybody to access this level of access this level of technology at the same kind of it with equity. Otherwise, you are you're handicapping up a significant portion of the world. And so we as the futurists and the technologists need to make sure we understand that and make sure that we include everyone in this and not just those with, not just those that are already on the precipice of it.
Yeah. So there's like that element of ethical considerations with regards to the application of these technologies, as well as like the privacy risks affiliated with when they're in use in general with like black hat hackers and how they maneuver privacy and data, which is two very different things, but not gonna lie, equally concerning for different reasons, of course.
And I think you're absolutely right. They're equally concerning, and the key is, you know, I would say if you look at any person that does any kind of data analysis, they say that two of the biggest data drivers right now are climate and health, right? So health data is what's being collected, you know, by my watch that I've got all day, every day. And all of these things, you know, they're encrypted now, they're somewhere on the cloud, and it's being used, you know, to make predictions about me. Now, using quantum to decrypt these things, somebody could find out exactly what my heart rate is. You know, an insurance person could say, well, you know, based on what we saw when, you know, off of this data, we're not going to give you a policy. And, you know, all of these things that can be concerning, or, you know, say, I don't want to tell someone my ethnic background, and I decided not to disclose that, but via any other methods, you know, other methods that they could use as a bad actor, they could figure out, you know, my background and then decide we're not going to give him a policy because, you know, he's a black man, or because, you know, he's a LGBTQ person. Like these things are things that really we have to be aware of, because we can further segregate our communities just based on that solely.
Yeah, it can really promote like those further disparities within the social characteristics and really affect the intersectionality of people, especially in places that like promote pluralism, sort of like Canada and the US. And we've seen those efforts kind of try to get hindered before. And I guess this is just going to be the way that technology might try to do it. And so it's important to just remain aware of those things. So that actually touches part one of our interview with regards to trade. And so now we're going to kind of move towards another section, being the security implications, which we've sort of touched on towards the end of part one. The first question is, what are the main security threats that arise from the development and deployment of quantum computing technology when they are present, if they have not been sort of answered before?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest threat with quantum computing is its ability to decrypt encryption. I think that is, you know, so everything from your WhatsApp messages all the way to, you know, your phone calls to satellite communications. Quantum computing will make that a thing of the past. We're talking to your internet, right? So you're talking about HTTPS. decrypting that. So putting everything, decrypting everything and just allowing that to be open to the public. So all of your PII, I mean, your social security or your credit card records or your financial statements, all of that stuff can be easily found out and easily accessed by a bad actor. And I think that is why, the U.S. government has taken a stance on developing was it called PCR? I believe it's PCR. I'll tell you the exact name. PQC, post-quantum cryptography. So we know that the age is coming, and we know that there's going to be this cryptography that's coming that's going to be able to quantum cryptography that's going to be able to decrypt things. So now we've got to figure out how can we get ahead of that. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of countries are doing, but we're trying to figure out what that's going to look like, given the fact that we know that quantum computing will allow us to do it at a much, much faster speed. So when I tell people about it and I say, what's the biggest threat that quantum computing has, it's always going to be decryption of any type of cybersecurity that we've already got, cybersecurity measures we have now.
So on the topic, I guess, of decrypting encrypted data, this actually really ties into what I was curious about, which is, I guess, how does quantum computing, like how do these quantum computers impact and impede traditional encrypting methods? So I guess, how do they even decrypt them in the first place?
Sure. So I think the best way to explain that without going into, I'm not a cybersecurity expert, so somebody will get on your show and say, that's not exactly how that works. So I'm going to take a 30,000 foot view and give you my take on that based on the fact that I've written enough algorithms that I can tell you a bit about it. But the biggest thing is it's affecting the field of mathematics, right? So quantum computing is essentially being able to do tens of thousands to millions of calculations per second, right? And we have very fast computers that can do that now, but this takes it to a level, it possibly takes it to a level that we can't even fathom. And so if you just think about a brute force attack, right? So say you have a standard four-digit code that could be anything that you're going to try to, 1111, that's your code, right? It's allowing the computer to attack this over and over and over and over and over at lightning fast pace, right? So you could really decrypt, I mean, right now that's pretty easy for our standard computers, but that could be something that could be broken in seconds, if anything, with quantum computing. And so when you look at the type of encryptions that we have from the DoD encrypted national security level all the way down to your baseline encryptions, all of these things could be broken with just enough time and effort by, one quantum computer. If you imagine that you put these things together and then put them in series or parallel, you're talking about breaking down an entire infrastructure without, without breaking a sweat, essentially. And so that's the short answer is it allows computers to do massive, complex calculations extremely fast and things that are not even fathomable for us today. And so you're really just breaking down an encryption encryption wall very quickly.
So it's like breaking a code, but just at lightning speed.
At lightning
speed. And
exactly.
Our codes being very like difficult, complex codes. Right. And it just cracked them. Okay.
and so like some of the, be careful where I go here. Some of these encryption mechanisms that we have now are I gave a very simple example, but there are things, you have multi-factor authentication on your phone that changes every 6 seconds. Even those things every 5 seconds, those things are very easily broken given the fact of how fast they're doing these complex computations. And so we've got to stay a step ahead of it. So it's almost a cat and mouse game, really, of staying ahead of those type of technologies. And there's some right now that are just amazing, but we can't even begin to I've seen some things that it blows my mind. I don't know. I'm always saying, I don't know how we're going to red team, blue team. It's going to be amazing. So
only time will tell, I guess, about just where we can go with it. Oh, wow. Okay. So I guess in the sense of getting that sort of quantum computing advantage, can quantum computing be used for both defensive and offensive cybersecurity purposes? And what are the implications of that sort of dual use capability if countries begin to adopt sort of these technologies in their everyday policy regulatory strategies?
Absolutely. So again, it is dual use. We are already aware of potential application. And we don't have them all out, but we have an idea of what can be done. And so the, you know, one type of quantum computing, I'm going to call it computing, it's really quantum communications that's out right now. It's called QKD, quantum kit distribution. This is essentially a way to talk, a way to communicate, you know, using photons across very long distances, so very fast. And so that's something that is out right now. And we are trying to figure out, talking to a satellite extremely fast. So you're getting faster communications, you're getting faster response times, you're getting real life communications. These are things that are out and have in our in actual, you know, in use right now. I won't say who's using them. People can Google that. But these are, you know, that is a offensive capability, if you will, as well as a defensive capability, because those communications are also very much so encrypted. And so the other half of that is, well, how do you, if you want to decrypt it, how would we attack it and how would we decrypt it, right? And so once you figure out how to break that, now you're saying, okay, so I know I've broken a quantum communication, so how do I do that in other areas? And so now I can use that
again after I could use it for, and then it cut. And
So we could use it. So essentially, a nation state actor could use those in order to disrupt communications. I'll keep it there. A nation state actor can use those to disrupt communication so that they may be able to cut two people off that are talking to each other. So that's kind of like a offensive and a defensive capability, depending on which person you are, right? So if you are trying to stop two people from talking and you figure out a way to decrypt that, then you can do that. On the other half of that, if you're the person being stopped from talking, it becomes a defensive capability on how do I get my communication line back up? What do I need to do? Should I be phasing it? You know, different ways to attack the same problem. From an encryption standpoint, though, I think the biggest part of that is the biggest positive, in my opinion, is, you know, everybody's heard about blockchain and trusted ledgers, and that's like a big thing right now and across the world. Crypto obviously is a very big thing. Quantum allows us to verify these trusted sources so much faster. Allowing you to make transactions faster, allowing you to do things from a financial standpoint so much faster because the computer, you know, there's an encryption that goes out there that's now quantum encryption. It can verify it extremely quickly and then get you your transaction back extremely fast. So these are things that on a more positive side, we're really trying to employ, you know, blockchain technology to really work in that quantum space. So, you know, instantaneous, you know, purchase of, you know, whatever you want to do. You take your iPhone and you purchase something in you know, 1 second, which is pretty fast now, but it could be faster. We live in a world where everything is bigger, faster, stronger. So, you know, I think that is something that we want to continue to kind of implement. So I'm excited. I'm excited about the applications that we can have, as well as, you know, some stuff on the other side that's a little bit fun.
I'm more of like concerned as well as excited at the exact same time. And so every time I dive into this topic more and more, the anxiety of it grows, but so does the excitement. So I'm just going to be along for the ride. And sort of that offensive, defensive question, actually brings me to my last question, which is in that context and in future applications of quantum computing serving to maybe harm countries, how can organizations or state actors prepare for the cybersecurity implications of quantum computing, particularly in terms of risk management and incident response as a post problem, as well as how does one prepare their sort of cyber resilience to prevent these problems, if that's even possible with quantum computing?
So that's a great question. It's the answer is, I'll give you my first answer is we don't know. We don't know because we don't know the implications of all of, or applications rather, of all of the types of things that could come out of quantum. Now, the second part of my answer is to answer the question of how can, you know, any country decide what they want to do. They need to at first, just on a bare minimum level, have a quantum infrastructure and a quantum plan, right? So what is our quantum plan? Because it's coming. It's not something that's not coming. It's coming. And it's just, are you going to be prepared for it when it launches or not? And so I think we need to really make sure we understand what that means. And one of the things we haven't talked about at all here, and forgive me for all of my quantum fans out there, one of the biggest implications and biggest, you know, I think one of the biggest benefits of quantum is going to be AI, right? So when we talk about doing all of these complex complex algorithm calculations, what we're really saying is, you know, AI is an algorithm that's doing a predictive tool. It's predicting something. It's predicting it very fast, whether it's, machine learning and talk to text, whether it's looking at thousands of points of data across the internet, it's just predicting something. Quantum is going to take that to the next level. So in a positive manner, we're not talking Terminator here, but we are talking, for my movie fans, my reference fans, Terminator or the Creator, we're not talking that far, but we are talking the ability to really have an interactive artificial intelligence really be able to benefit your life on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, how things can, how you're interacting with things, how you, in a real world setting, what you need to do, everything from, you know, VR goggles and things of that nature to interacting in a virtual, physical, cyber physical world. All of those things will become possible, which allows us to really like harness our human brain power. So I think that's a very exciting portion of that. I brought that up in this question because it's also a very scary portion of that, right? And that's, we talked about it a few minutes earlier, where you'll have the have and the have nots. We have those that are being able to utilize this technology and utilize access to all of this, what it is access to information and predictions, having that ability to access those things and make a reasonable decision, and those who will not. And so I will say every country needs to have some type of quantum plan. They need to think about this from from several points, right? Whatever they want to think about for their security concerns and how they're going to protect their citizens' data and their personal data for all of their citizens from any type of hacking or any type of hackers, but from a, how do we utilize it to better our citizens' lives, right? So I always think about, you know, offensive and defensive, again, capabilities. We can use this technology to truly enhance, you know, everyone on the planet's lives if we just really utilize it for good. Now, you know, we want to be altruistic and really hope that everybody does that. That's not always necessarily the case, but I still believe in the good in humanity. And I feel like we can solve climate control problems, you know, climate issues. We can solve food issues and food hunger issues. All of these things can be solved using that type of computing and calculation power. But we've got to be aware that some people may use it to shut down critical infrastructures, or they may use it to, get people's personally identified information, or they may use it to try to access, you know, nuclear weapon systems, that, or try to access someone's car, or try to access a jet or a plane. These, you know, all of these things become vulnerable given the power of that type of technology. And so that was a long answer. I'll shorten it to say, everybody needs to have a quantum plan. And I think, you know, an economic blueprint and an economic R&D investment plan in the quantum. And I think it's got to be multilateral. I think everybody's going to have to play this playpen together. And I think we all going to have to come together to really say, this is what's best for the world. And the needs of the many might necessarily not be the needs of the few. So we need to really kind of look at it from a global scale.
Take that international perspective when creating the technology that will ultimately and inevitably impact everyone at the international scale. That's fair. Well, those are actually it for my questions. So thank you so much for joining us today and taking your time. I know you're busy, and really just helping our listeners really get that insider sort of knowledge and opinions with regards to quantum computing and its growing proliferation in terms of development and R&D. So we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me. Love folks in Toronto. It's one of my favorite cities in the world.
You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Professor Darius Ornston from the University of Toronto and Dr. Joseph Bonneville from the Atlantic Council Geotech Center. Many thanks to them for coming on to today's show to discuss the implications of quantum computing. Today's show was produced by myself, Ananya Malabatla, alongside my co-producer and co-host, Sarah Fian. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you're listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net. As well, you can check it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, please follow us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram.